From the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, updates on Coral Castle in Florida. Amazing updates. Here's what's happening. Amazing statistics. Tens of thousands of American deaths last winter believed to have been caused by the flu and its related complications, making it the most severe flu season in at least four decades. According to Dr. Robert Redfield, the director for the Centers of Disease Control and Prevention, we lost 80,000 people last year to the flu, he says. That number is thought to be the highest death toll for the flu since the winter of 1976-77. As an extraordinary series of uncorroborated last-minute allegations threatens to derail his confirmation to the Supreme Court, nominee Brett Kavanaugh and Christine Ford, the California professor accusing him of sexually assaulting her more than three decades ago, are set to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee Thursday morning. The proceedings threaten to be upended by late-breaking developments. Here's what's been going on. Tonight, the Judiciary Committee Republicans have revealed that they conducted their own first interview with a man who believes that he, not Judge Kavanaugh, had the encounter with Dr. Ford in 1982 and is the basis of the complaint. They conducted a second interview the next day, and on Wednesday, the Republicans said, they received a much more in-depth written statement from that man interviewed twice previously, who believes that he, not Judge Kavanaugh, had the encounter in question with Dr. Ford when they were teenagers. GOP investigators also spoke on the phone with another man who's making a similar claim. Ford has previously said there is zero chance that she would have confused Kavanaugh for anyone else. Now, the key swing vote senators have said that at Thursday's hearing, which will begin at 10 a.m. Eastern Time, it presents a pivotal opportunity to assess Ford's credibility and determine whether to advance Kavanaugh to the nation's highest court. Four others, by the way, have alleged improprieties. They have come forward, too. President Donald Trump defended Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh at a news conference today, saying the Democrats had destroyed a man's reputation. First, let's check in with Dr. John Curtis, onlinecolumnist.com. He's been looking at this situation since it unfolded. John, what an unbelievable story.
Oh, it really is. And this really makes the Clarence Thomas situation look like, a non-event, basically. Well, these are some really spectacular and outrageous allegations that are being made. First of all, the main claim, plaintiff here is this Blasey Ford suggesting that when she was 15 years of age, she was somehow locked in a room at a party, some unknown Maryland home, where she's claiming that Kavanaugh tried to peel off her clothes and, you know, put his hand over her mouth. So we're looking at something that happened 36 years ago. She's got a number of witness statements, but the witnesses are not people that observed anything. They're not eyewitnesses. They're people that she's told that this has happened. Now, George, and you know this from your show for many, many years, there is something called false memory syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody's talking
mm-hmm.
about it right now because it's very politically incorrect, because the Me Too movement wants everybody to believe that if you don't accept lock, stock, and barrel the facts of a 15-year-old as it's been gone through machination after machination over the last 36 years, never reported at the time that if it was that severe, that egregious, that horrific of an event, what she's calling an attempted rape, you would think that she would have told somebody at the time. And they're saying, oh, no, women don't tell people. No, a lot of them do. Now, if she didn't say anything, then, well, maybe it wasn't quite the way she's described it. So you've got, you know, these other women coming out of the woodwork, one of whom named Deborah Ramirez from his days at Yale, suggesting that somehow he engaged in some kind of sexual misbehavior at a dorm party. And then today, the media hound Michael Avenatti has, you know, brought up...
That's Stormy Daniels' attorney, by the way.
Stormy Daniels' attorney has now brought up this woman, Spetnik, who's, like, concocted this incredible story of daisy chain gang bang kind of events that, you know, this that Kavanaugh was involved with in drugging women and, you know, somehow inducing them to go through these kind of, you know, inappropriate and abusive sex acts. So I think what you've got right now is that nobody really knows what's going on.
No, that's the biggest problem, John. Nobody really knows what's going on. He's Kavanaugh is either, you would think, a monster, or the guy's totally innocent in all this.
And I think what's going to happen tomorrow, and this is, George, getting into my prediction of what I think is going to, what the outcome of this whole thing is going to be. I think if Blasey Ford gets through this hearing without looking like a nut job, and she presents a rather
compelling argument,
logical case against Kavanaugh, then I think that Kavanaugh loses at least one of the GOP female senators, either Murkowski or Susan Collins, and that sinks his nomination.
Well, watch this for us tomorrow and give us your analysis tomorrow night, John. Another perspective, of course, is the author of The Genius of the Beast, Howard Bloom. Howard, I want your perspective on this situation.
Well, you know, we've got America living in two different perceptual worlds like right now. There's the Republican worldview, and there's the Democratic worldview. And some of the things that John said are valid. For example, there is false memory syndrome. It's a basic part of memory that we get things wrong. But the fact is, five people, as you mentioned, are the ones who've come forward. First, there's Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, and we know what's going on with her. And the reason that Kavanaugh, she says, covered her mouth was she was trying to scream. And then, and like the victims of sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, Ford says that she was too ashamed to tell this to anyone for 30 years. She just began confessing to it 6 years ago to her friends. But when she saw that her abuser, the man she felt was her abuser, was about to ascend to the Supreme Court, she felt compelled by public virtue to open up. Meanwhile, accuser number two is Deborah Ramirez, and she says that during a drinking game at Yale in a dorm party, Kavanaugh took out his sexual organ and tried to get her to touch it, and the crowd was roaring him on. Now, alcohol played a major role in the Christine Blasey Ford incident and also in this Ramirez incident, and this tends to be a pattern. The third accuser is a Colorado resident who writes anonymously to her senator, Republican Cory Gardner, about an incident when Kavanaugh, then living in Washington, went to a bar for drinks with what appears to be five friends. And once again, alcohol looms large in the picture. Coming out of the bar, Kavanaugh allegedly shoved one of the women up against a wall very aggressively and sexually. The fourth accusation is from a man in Rhode Island who says a female friend of his was raped on a boat by what he believes was Brett Kavanaugh, and the same friend who was in the room with Kavanaugh when Christine Ford Blasey says that she was being raped or an attempted rape by Kavanaugh. But the most chilling of all is the Avenatti one, because it comes in a sworn deposition from Julie Swetnick, who grew up in the suburbs of Washington near Kavanaugh. Now, Swetnick claims that in Kavanaugh's high school years, she saw roughly 10 parties in which the boys in Kavanaugh's crowd would spike the punch with grain alcohol and drugs like Quaaludes and corner an easy target, a girl too stoned to resist, get her into a bedroom. Then the boys would allegedly line up in the corridor in a train to rape her one by one. Swetnick says that she was one of those gang rape victims and she was too drunk to move. Now, I went to one of these private schools with a lot of these kids who were really heavily into the alcohol culture. And in what I observed around me, they didn't invite me to their parties. I can't claim to be an eyewitness to this kind of thing. But this kind of thing that Swetnick is talking about was in the air among these kids.
It was. Hazing and all that other stuff was there, too. But still, you know, here's a guy's reputation that could be destroyed.
Oh, it's very important.
And we still don't have real evidence yet.
But the reason is that the committee is avoiding real evidence. They say they are interviewing people, but it sounds to me like they are not interviewing them. They are intimidating.
Well, I look forward to giving us a report tomorrow night. Okay, Howard?
Terrific.
All right, we'll see you then. The hearing is at 10 o'clock Eastern Time in the morning. It'll probably have ratings higher than the Super Bowl. A Texas man has been arrested for reportedly gluing an infant's mouth and eye shut while at a hotel. What's wrong with people? The Federal Reserve has raised interest rates another 0.25%. It keeps going up little by little. William Cooper was an American conspiracy theorist. He was a shortwave radio broadcaster, and he was an author, best known for his 1991 book, Behold a Pale Horse. He was killed in a 2001 shootout with police. They came to arrest him. He shot a police officer in the head. He was then shot and killed. Some of his thoughts and predictions were uncanny. He talked about the possibility of the dangers of what ended up being 9/11. In 1997, CNN interviewed Osama bin Laden. 1997, keep in mind, 4 years before 9/11. William Cooper had seen that interview and made these comments.
Can you believe what you have been seeing on CNN today, ladies and gentlemen? Can you believe it? Supposedly, a CNN reporter found Osama bin Laden took a television camera crew with him, went into Osama bin Laden's hideout, interviewed him and his top leadership, his top lieutenants and colonels and generals in their hideout. This is a CNN reporter with a camera crew. And he came out and told everybody, within 3 weeks, Osama bin Laden is going to attack the United States and Israel. Now, don't you think that's kind of strange, folks? You see, because the largest intelligence apparatus in the world, with the biggest budget in the history of the world, has been looking for Osama bin Laden for years and years and years, and can't find him. A reporter from CNN and his little camera crew got in to Osama bin Laden's secret hideout and conducted an interview. If you don't believe me, tune into CNN. They're probably running it right now as I'm speaking. And if you believe it, you are one of the stupidest jerks that ever lived on the face of this earth. And whatever is going to happen that they're going to blame on Osama bin Laden, don't you even believe it. When in hell are all you people going to wake up?
Pretty prophetic. In a moment, Mark Jacobson joins us. His latest book, Pale Horse Rider, William Cooper, The Rise of Conspiracy and the Fall of Trust in America. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Let me tell you about our guest for the next couple hours. Mark Jacobson has been a working journalist for the past 45 years. He's born and bred in New York, and over the years, he's been employed by the New York Magazine, Rolling Stone, Esquire, the National Geographic, among many other publications. His New York piece, Night Shifting for the Hip Fleet, was adapted into a long-running television series called Taxi. And in 2000, he wrote Return of Superfly, which served as the basis for the hit film American Gangster. Jacobson's most recent book, of course, is Pale Horse Rider, William Cooper, The Rise of Conspiracy and the Fall of Trust in America. My pleasure to bring Mark Jacobson in. Mark, excellent book, by the way. I got to tell you, you did a great job on this story.
Well, thanks a lot. It's nice to hear. But I don't think that Bill Cooper couldn't have predicted this Kavanaugh business. I don't think.
Oh, my gosh. He'd be going crazy right now with this.
Oh, he would be going crazy.
What a story. You know,
it's an extraordinary story. I mean, I hope this interview is over so I can get up and watch the thing tomorrow morning.
You know, I took over the reins of the show in 2003, so Bill Cooper had been dead a couple of years before that. I never had a chance to interview this person. But for our audience, our vast audience, Mark, give us just a little highlight of who Bill Cooper was.
Well, Cooper is an interesting figure. He's sort of like a lot of... He always used to say, well, I'm just an ordinary guy, and in a lot of respects, he really was. I mean, he was born in 1943. He was in a military family. He came of age around the time of the Vietnam War, and he served in the military. He went to Vietnam, and he was a PT boat captain on the Quabbiet River, which is only 12 miles from the DMZ, if people remember.
Right.
And he came home, and he acquitted himself quite well out there. Came home with a pretty healthy case of PTSD. wound up in the VA hospital a couple of times, and just sort of tried to live his life with a lot of bumps. He was married a few times, didn't end well. And then around the late 1980s, he came upon the scene. I mean, I'm sure that people at Coast to Coast listeners, the older ones, probably remember all this stuff about MJ-12.
Oh, sure. They still do. They still do.
MJ-12. And then when in the late 1980s, the UFO scene, which had kind of been a big, you know, huge deal during the 50s and 60s, but it kind of was, it lay dormant for a while. This is before Roswell came on the horizon. And then and Cooper said that he had seen several documents while he was in naval intelligence proving the existence of aliens on the Earth and the fact that the U.S. government had been covering it up. And he had a lot of specific details about this, including one of the highlights was that the U.S. government and President Dwight D. Eisenhower had actually met with aliens sometime in 1954 at Edwards Air Force Base, and they signed this treaty, which was enabled the U.S. to get this alien technology in exchange, more or less, for abducting our citizens, and many things of that nature. And Cooper was a very controversial figure in the UFO thing. There are people who would easily tell you that he was the most hated man in the history of ufology, mostly because of his kind of aggressive personality.
No, he hated our former late host, Art Bell. He apparently, I have heard,
he hated Art Bell. He would sit on his porch listening to the Art Bell show and just argue with every single thing that Art said. And
I don't know if Art ever had him on the program here.
I don't believe he did.
I think he tried once, but it never happened.
Well, Cooper was on a show which predated Art's show, which is the Billy Goodman Happening, if everybody remembers.
That's right.
That.
Out of Vegas, wasn't it?
Out of Vegas. Yeah. And Cooper was a big star in that show, and he had he was the most outrageous of all these people because didn't mind doing this.
Yet his credentials, Mark, were real. He was truly in naval intelligence. He was a Vietnam vet. Those were real, right?
Oh, those are real. Those are real. I mean, I did a lot of research on this. Those are definitely real. What he exactly did in naval intelligence is somewhat of a mystery. But what he claimed that he had access to all this information, and because he was able to look into these drawers where they kept this secret information, and these must have been some of the biggest drawers in the history of cabinet making.
Oh my God!
A lot of stuff in there. So, and Bill Cooper often quoted these things and claimed that he had seen them. I have no way of telling what he saw and what he didn't see, but he made a lot of claims, and a lot of people argued with him, and there was a lot of fighting and yelling. And then Cooper. Immediately, one day, he woke up in the morning, and he decided there was no such thing as UFOs. In fact, this was all a gigantic hoax. And, in fact, it was a distraction to keep people from understanding what was really going on, which was that secret societies, like the Illuminati and other people like that, were actually running the show. And this UFO thing was to keep people...
A diversion.
It's a diversion. In other words, Cooper is the popularizer. I don't think it's really his term, but he's certainly the popularizer of the word sheeple. You know, and he popularizes this term, which is still, you hear it almost every day.
Well, he was extremely intuitive, Mark. I mean, you heard that little clip right before you came on.
Oh, yeah.
He was talking about...
One of his most famous broadcasts.
Oh, my God,
probably his most famous broadcast.
He was, like, spot on. And then, he basically predicted 9/11 by telling people something big is going to happen. You just watch. And it did.
Well, the thing that really stood out to people was that he claimed that something was going to happen and they're going to blame it on Osama bin Laden. That was his contribution.
Years before 9/11.
Years before. Well, actually, that broadcast that you played was only...
4 years. 4 years before.
No, the broadcast itself.
Oh, that broadcast. His broadcast.
That broadcast itself was done on June 28th, 2001.
That's right.
About 6 or 8 weeks.
Hold on for a second, Mark. We're at the break, but we'll come back and pick all this up. Next hour, we'll take calls with you as well. Mark Jacobson with us. His book, Pale Horse Rider, William Cooper, The Rise of Conspiracy and the Fall of Trust in America. In a moment, we'll be back with Mark Jacobson as we talk about the life of William Cooper. Mark's book is Pale Horse Rider. It's an amazing story. We'll take calls with you next hour as well. If any of you used to listen to Bill Cooper on his shortwave radio broadcast, check in with us then as well. And welcome back, Mark Jacobson with us. Mark, what was it that compelled you to write the story of Bill Cooper?
Well, I mean, first, let me say that I've been waiting to be on this show ever since I used to listen to Long John Neville.
Well, you made it, my friend.
Thank you, George.
And you're out there. You're still in Brooklyn. You're on WOR right now in the big city.
Well, that's fantastic, WOR.
That's the one Neville was on, yeah.
Oh, yeah, Long John Neville was... I got a lot of trouble because of Long John Neville. My parents always screaming at me to shut that junk off and go to bed and do my homework.
That's right. You couldn't get to sleep.
Well, you know, Long John Neville was a lot more interesting than any kind of homework I was supposed to be doing. So in any event, well, the thing about Bill Cooper is he's a fascinating figure. I mean, there's something about him followers, he's bigger now than he ever was in a way. Well,
yeah, no, you're right. His books have sold more copies now than when he was alive when he wrote it.
Well, the book, Behold the Pale Horse, which is that's his big book. It's his only book. And he wrote that came out in 1991 and had a press run of 3,500. Now it's sold more than 300,000 copies.
Jeez.
Continues to sell. It's still the number one rated book on Amazon. You can look that up right now. In the Ancient and Controversial Knowledge, still number one. And you know there's a lot of competition for that particular slot.
Absolutely.
And he's always in the top 20 among all books about the paranormal. So, I mean, why is that? I mean, it's an interesting question. And I first became aware of Bill Cooper by some kind of odd chance where I saw the Zapruder film. People do remember the Zapruder film, I hope. It's the only record of the Kennedy assassination.
Mm-hmm.
So now here's the crime of the century. You know, it's not even an argument. This is the crime of the century.
It's the crime of the century, no doubt.
The crime of the century. The president of the United States is shot dead in front of, like, you know, hundreds of people are watching, and still they can't solve the crime. I mean, on TV, they're solving the crime every hour. You know, the cops are solving murders all the time, yet they can't figure out who did it. And even though it's been broad daylight, and, I mean, I would challenge anybody to go out and walk around and find one person that believes that Lee Harvey Oswald, you know, was the killer and acted alone, like the Warren Commission said. So the Zapruder film was the only record of this. And at that time, which is something we're not very well known, the Zapruder film was almost impossible to see. Because Time Life, Henry Luce, Time Life, March of Time, you know, Time Magazine, Life Magazine, they took a 50-year option on the Zapruder film, and they gave Abraham Zapruder, the man that shot the film, $150,000 for it.
And that was in 1963 dollars.
Yes. And they also, I must add, they also took a 50-year option on the life story of Marina Oswald, because they claimed that they were going to do a big story and make a movie out of it. They never did it.
Right.
So, if you're slightly suspicious about this kind of stuff, that might add to your suspicion. So, in any event, there was a couple of copies of the Zapruder film that was floating around, and they were in terrible condition. Nobody could see it because they should dupe the film over and over again. And remember, this is a 16-millimeter film. It's not like some kind of videotape or something like that. It gets more and more difficult to see what's going on. And then if it got more difficult to see, you would see funny kind of things in there. And Bill Cooper was claiming that the actual murderer of John Kennedy was the driver of the car, a Secret Service agent named William Greer, who turned around and shot the president in the head right in the middle of the motorcade. And he was, and nobody else noticed this, but Cooper was saying that he could see it in the Zapruder film. And actually, you know, as somebody who watched the film many times, I think that if you had a few drinks, you might be able to see it yourself. But
you could see him turning and looking. I couldn't see, you know, like a handgun in his hand or anything like that.
Something that looks a little like a handgun, but most people believe it was the reflection of the sun off the
right
milk-creamed head of the other Secret Service agent who was in the front seat. But in any event, Cooper was going around, and you know, he was one of these kind of guys who was like, you know, half a prophet and half a huckster, like many people are.
And he's a wild man too, Mark. He was
totally wild man. I mean, there's famous stories about Bill Cooper getting in big fist fights with a guy named Eric Bechtjord, I believe his name was. And he was a expert on the Bigfoot, and he was also a big guy. Cooper was a huge guy, made about 250, probably went about 6'4", and he got a. Bechtjord was even bigger than him, and they had a famous duke out at one of these conventions.
Jeez.
And so Cooper wrote, and then he did that, and then how I got interested in him kind of was that I was walking down the street in Brooklyn, and this is now, we're talking about 1992, maybe something like that.
Okay.
And what was happening then, at least in New York, was this music, hip-hop music, was coming, was appearing on the scene. And there was a famous group from New York, became famous, called the Wu-Tang Clan. I hope that people know who that is. And there was one of the guys from the Wu-Tang Clan named Old Dirty Bastard. That was his name, ODB. And I saw him reading a copy of Behold the Pale Horse, which I didn't even know anything about at the time. And then later I found out, and I was thinking, like, why is this guy reading that book sitting on a stoop in Brooklyn? And then later it became apparent to me that not only was Behold the Pale Horse selling a lot of copies in the bookstores, but it was also the most read book in the United States prison system.
And by the way, Pale Horse is tied into the Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. It's a it's a biblical story.
It is a biblical story. It's Behold the Pale Horse, and it's actually the fourth of the Four Horsemen, the Pale Horse who carried death. You know, that is the symbol of death. And Cooper used that phrase from it's from the book of Revelations, chapter 6, verse 8. And it just seemed like a kind of, as a journalist, you know, more somebody who's, like, interested in, like, how things happen, I just began to monitor this over the years because still to this day, Behold the Pale Horse is the most shoplifted book in the Barnes & Noble's chain.
Really?
It's true.
Huh.
Cooper used to brag about that on the radio show. He thought that was wonderful, which, you know, from his point of view, I mean, if I wrote that book, I'd feel the same way. But it just sort of became this kind of interesting thing because after that, like rappers, guys like Tupac Shakur and all these famous rappers were beginning to mention Bill Cooper and Behold the Pale Horse in their raps.
In their songs, yeah.
In their songs. So this, to me, seemed interesting because Bill Cooper is basically, you know, I mean, if you saw him walking down the street, you think, oh, here's a big, overweight white guy who lives on top of a mountain in Arizona, who's doing a shortwave radio, and basically the last few years of his life, he was more or less on the Patriot circuit, and he was involved with the militia movement and everything like that. So why are these black guys in New York City reading his book? So, and that was the beginning of my insertion into Bill Cooper, and it took a few years to really begin to grok that entire cosmos of what was happening there. The word grok comes from Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein, which is an old hippie book.
Was Cooper, in your opinion, Mark, was he paranoid?
Well, I mean, paranoid is a difficult word to figure out, especially in this day and age. because, I mean, a little paranoia is a good thing. We all agree that. That's true. Because, you know, there is a sort of sense that, like, you know, people are out to get you. And I think that was partially one of the reasons why Cooper's, I mean, Cooper was a guy, he went to Vietnam. I mean, a lot of this stuff, I mean, most people that don't follow history and aren't old enough to really remember it don't understand what the Vietnam War meant to the feeling of the confidence of people just being an American. Because Bill Cooper is from a military family. He goes to Vietnam because he believes in freedom. And that's really the main bottom line for Bill Cooper.
Right.
Freedom. Like, what is freedom? What does it mean?
Constitution, all that stuff.
All that stuff. And so he believes that he's going to Vietnam to defend the Constitution as his father did in World War II and all kinds of stuff. And then he gets over there and he realizes, like, well, I mean, am I fighting on the right side here? I mean, you know, what is going on? You know, and all this stuff comes out about the war and, you know, McNamara and these different things, you know, the
And they're hated. Unfortunately, the soldiers are hated at home by protesters.
Well, the protesters, you know, he comes back. He's not given a ticker tape parade or anything like that the way other American people have put their life on the line wearing the uniform of the United States. And, you know, it's a very disorienting situation. And I think that a lot of the stuff that we're going through right now finds its origin right there. You know, people believing that, like, you know, I'm growing up, I'm in New York, and I'm thinking that, well, there's two kinds of people in the world. There's the straight people and the hip people, you know. And as I grew up, I began to realize that perhaps those little dichotomies, those, like, one side against the other side, is really not the way the world really is. I mean, people are all different. Everybody's different. So, but everybody wants to put people into a particular bag. You know, they're either Democrats or Republicans, or they believe this or they believe that. And I think that Cooper was somebody who was against that. He rebelled against those kind of dichotomies and categories that people put themselves in. And he was a heartbroken guy because he began to believe that his government, you know, which he believed in 100%, was full of liars and deception. So, and that's really where the UFO thing is really the beginning of a lot of the stuff that, you know, that we deal with now, because the UFO thing was the first time that a sizable percentage of the population believed something and the government told them it was not true.
Right, exactly. He also had a big fan, though, with Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City bomber, didn't he?
Oh, yes. I mean, McVeigh was a big listener of Bill Cooper and listened to him all the time. This is completely documented in different interviews with people that were friends with McVeigh. And Michael Fortier was one of these
He
guys.
Was one of those, yeah.
Yeah, he didn't really, he never...
His name was kicked around in the beginning.
His name was kicked around, and then he turned state's evidence against McVeigh. But
Nichols is probably still in jail, isn't he?
Fortier, I don't think so. Actually.
No, Terry Nichols.
Oh, Terry Nichols is in Florence with Charles Manson and those other guys.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, that's the supermax. He's over there. So McVeigh, Cooper tells the story, which there's no reason not to believe it, because actually later on the FBI came to visit Cooper to ask him about this, so they certainly believed it. Cooper was doing his broadcast in St. John's in Arizona, which is near where he lived, in Eagar, Arizona, which is in the extreme eastern part of the state. It's not the Arizona that most people think about with the cactuses and everything. It's a big mountainous area. And Cooper was doing his broadcast, and these two guys, one tall, skinny guy and another short guy, and they came to visit him. And people came in and said, there's two guys here to visit you, and would you talk to them? So Cooper says, sure. Guys come in, and one of them is a big, tall, is a skinny, tall guy. Looks a lot like Timothy McVeigh. And McVeigh, and they're talking to Cooper, and they're asking him, they admired Cooper and were listening to a lot of the stuff he said, and they were, McVeigh, who hadn't said anything throughout the entire, the other guys did all the talking, McVeigh turns to Cooper and says, look, if you're stopped on the road and a cop stops you, would you shoot him?
Oh, jeez.
So, Cooper said, well, why would you shoot him? And he said, well, you know, just because, you know, because what should you do? And so Cooper said, look, I mean, do you have any warrants out for your arrest? You know, do you have any reason why you would do that? And McVeigh said, no. And so Cooper said that, look, just take your ticket if you were speeding and just go on your way.
Go away. Yeah.
Go away. So this guy, the McVeigh figure, says, okay, that's fine. So actually, later on, after McVeigh either did or didn't do what he did, he was actually driving away in that car without a license plate, if people remember
that. That's how he got arrested.
I mean, you know, if you just killed 168 people and you're trying to get away, you might have a license plate on your car.
Yeah, you would think so.
You would think. So, in any event, so that was not the case. So these guys, somewhere in northern Oklahoma, highway patrolman stops McVeigh, and says, you don't got a license plate there. And McVeigh says, well, you know, yeah, I guess. And then McVeigh is actually armed, and he could have actually shot the cop and got away. So 168 makes it 169. What's the difference?
Maybe he thought of what Bill Cooper told him.
Thought of what Bill Cooper said, and he got arrested. That's how McVeigh was arrested. That's how he was apprehended.
Ironically, Mark, Bill Cooper dies because sheriff deputies come to arrest him for a warrant, and he shoots one of them in the head.
Well, that's an interesting point, because when you talk about Bill Cooper's predictions, in other words, he predicted
his own death, didn't he?
He predicted his own death, and not only did he predict his own death, which is one of the very uncanny and interesting things about Bill Cooper. He not only predicted his own death, but he predicted the time and the exact place. He said on the radio, they're going to come up here and kill me. They're going to shoot me dead on my front doorstep at midnight. Now, Bill Cooper was shot dead on his front doorstep, and the time of death is something like 12:10.
Jeez.
Close. You know, maybe he was off by 10 minutes. But, I mean, there is certain factual matters that kind of contradict some of the legendary things about Bill Cooper, which he was not shot by the feds. He was shot by the Apache County Sheriff's.
That's right. If he wasn't so destructive, self-destructive, this guy could have been a monster in terms of our rights, predicting the Illuminati, the deep state. I mean, this...
Well, he did. He was one of the first...
He was way ahead of his time.
Well, I mean, I think he was too far ahead of his time in a way. I mean, when you're too far ahead of the curve, you know...
You're looked at as a nutshell.
People don't pay attention to you.
That's right.
The times... But, I mean, I think that he was such a person that he kind of saw things... If the wheel of time is moving, he was a little ahead, so he could see what was going to happen.
What a visionary. Mark, we're going to come back and talk more about your book, Pale Horse Rider, and we'll take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.